I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. I'll be out of the office all week, so no update of the commodity markets. However, I wanted to start the week with some information on COVID-19, the coronavirus, as it relates to human populations and what we can learn about infectious diseases as they are managed in farm production systems. Jim Lowe from the University of Illinois, along with Ashley Mitek, did a podcast on this last week called the Round Barn Podcast. They've given me permission to do some editing on that to pass this along. And a conversation recorded last Thursday, March 12th, by the way, started with Ashley asking Jim Loeb if it makes sense to shut down places where people gather in larger numbers.
Well, Ashley, I mean, it's a challenge, right? Because we don't have a vaccine. The virus is spreading rapidly. We are in an epidemic. And so we are trying to flatten the epidemic curve. We're trying to have fewer cases.
What do you mean by flatten the epidemic curve?
So that's the fancy medical term, right, we use when we think about new cases. And so we tend to track the number of new cases per day. And the last week, it's been going up very rapidly. And so if you think about putting the number of cases per day on a chart and just drawing a line graph, we're going up, and it tends to go up. And then at some point we run out of infected people and or infected animals and, you know, the world you and I live in every day. And then the number of new cases starts to drop every day. So it's kind of like a mountain. You go up the mountain and then you come down the mountain. And the goal with all of these strategies is to make the mountain a little shorter. So we're not going to stop this disease. I mean, it's the genie's clearly out of the bottle. It's moving around. So the challenge now, you know, as we talked last time on one of these podcasts, is how do we minimize its impact? And that really means how do I have fewer total cases, or how do I take those cases, even if I don't change the number, how do I make those cases occur over a longer period of time so I don't overwhelm the healthcare system and really put a lot of pressure on, you know, at high at-risk populations.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt from time to time when there's an important point I think that needs repeated. Flattening the curve does not necessarily mean there will be fewer cases, though that is the goal. It does mean there will be fewer cases each day in hopes of not overwhelming the healthcare system.
So I don't overwhelm the healthcare system and really put a lot of pressure on, you know, at high at-risk populations. So we've identified, and they were just talking this morning on the news, that, you know, the case fatality rate in people over 80 is higher than it is in people over 60 and et cetera, et cetera. And so how do we protect, we've seen the mass in Seattle in the nursing home, which unfortunately is probably what is to be expected. We put a novel disease in a group that's probably not very immunocompetent in a really close location with a lot of contact, and you're going to see a massive outbreak and, unfortunately, right, a high rate of mortality, much higher than other cases. And so all of these things we're doing are all designed to lower that. And my favorite term is social distancing. We're just trying to minimize that impact. And all of this is to how do we decrease the chance of contact between infecteds and susceptibles. And really, how do we minimize the contact between infecteds and really vulnerable?
So that's why the universities have come out and said, we're going to essentially cancel classes or switch to an online environment. And essentially now we're trying to minimize those interactions. But I guess the question is that really going to benefit us as a community? Or is it just sending the disease back to wherever they're from?
I think the real thought is that we're heading into spring break season. If you look at all these universities that are stopping class being taught in person, it's all associated with spring break. And so we're going to send people from this campus all over and then bring them back. And so the fear is, right, we live in a community of 100,000 people. And so all of a sudden we bring 50,000 students back, or whatever the number of those that are traveling. That wouldn't be all of them, obviously, but some percentage back into here. And so do we put our community at risk that we live in? And do we put them at risk? Because it's really commingling. It's this mixing. We take it from all over the place and bring them back. So I think if we were post spring break and this was happening, we might see a different response, because, well, they're already here. So let's not send them off into the wild. But because they're going to go into the wild, because we're in this spot that they're going to leave, I think it does make some sense not to bring them back and put them at risk and put the community at risk, et cetera.
One of the questions that our college is getting asked a lot is, can dogs and other pets get COVID-19? And we've been trying really hard to educate the public not to panic about this, that there is no evidence that dogs can become sick from this disease and that they can spread it to humans. How do we combat this, what is seems to be now a panic state of this virus? Everybody thinking, you know, they're going to get this virus and it has a very high potential mortality rate compared to the flu, at least. What should be the right message of panic level to the public right now?
Well, the human mind's an interesting thing, isn't it, right? Because we talk about this in we have tens of thousands of people that die from influenza. Influenza kills tens of thousands of people a year. And that doesn't make the news. And this makes the news because it's new and we talk about it. You know, as an infectious disease person, it's really easy to be a bit cynical and say, yeah, this is what we'd expect and it's not that big a deal. But, you know, if you're, that's really good as long as you're not the one who dies, right? So the mortality rate's really low, but if you're the one who dies, that's a, unfortunately, all of a sudden that's really important to you, right? So I think those are the challenges. I think there's been some messaging challenges because we haven't been able to test as much as we'd like to. We really don't know the number of infections. You know, there are probably tens or hundreds or thousands more infections than we've reported as cases. And the cases are basically what we've tested positive. And because we know there are people who are asymptomatically affected or very mildly affected and they didn't get tested and those aren't getting reported, et cetera, et cetera. So the actual percentage of people who are dying of those that are infected is much, much, much lower, several orders of magnitude lower than what's happening. But there are still mortalities and there is still concern. And because we don't have a great control strategy, that's becomes a challenge, right? So it's having dealt with this on the livestock side, which is obviously a whole lot less important than a human pandemic. But we dealt with a novel disease introduction in pig populations here in 2013-14 that was a pandemic within the pigs. It spread across all the pigs in the country with relatively high mortality rates. And we're talking about African swine fever coming to the U.S. I mean, it's the same conversation.
Just for clarification, African swine fever is a disease of pigs only and not of humans.
You see the same behavior with that those groups that are affected, right? That panic sets in and we really start to make some what are probably irrational decisions. And so we've talked about all these movements, right? We put travel bans in and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we put a travel ban in last night with Europe for 30 days. And whether that's reasonable or not is way, way above my pay grade.
Is that what you would do with pigs? In this type of situation.
Yeah, that's absolutely. Yeah, it's so much easier in our world because we would just say we're going to quit moving things.
We would just shut down the pig farm.
Nothing comes in, nothing comes out, or the things that are going out only go to harvest. And so it's obviously easy to do that with livestock. Well, it's not perfectly easy to do that with livestock, but there aren't all the moral and ethical issues around that, right? And so one of the challenges in the country we live in, right, we can't make those big edicts and say no one goes anywhere anytime. How I would just scientifically line up my head and say we need to go do X, Y, and Z, we know those tools work. We're going to quit moving anything. We're going to go to strict disinfection. We wouldn't let people come in and out of a pig farm without taking a shower and changing their clothes. And if I ask you to, hey, you can't come to work without taking a shower and changing your clothes when you come in, like you have to wear the clothes of the company when you're here, the university, right? That's going to be no, not doing that. And so, I mean, there's just some, we know the hyper-effective tools that work when they're implemented aren't really practical in this case, aren't within our ethics and values. And so we have to try some of these other things in terms of let's not have people go to class. Let's not have people go to meetings. Let's stop travel. How do we have meetings virtually?
So it seems like the two biggest things that we really can do at this point is to prevent people movement or exposure to large crowds or commingling, and then also just basic common sense of wash your hands type thing. And is there anything else in that message to the communities that are going to be affected by this of what they can do?
Well, I think we have to prioritize, right? So if we have high-risk individuals, so people who are older or people who have underlying health conditions or both, and unfortunately those go together, right, often. We need to put a lot of extra emphasis around those folks and say, how do we really do outreach and how do we do improve infection control, hand hygiene around those kinds of folks. So we're closing nursing homes in the community and that kind of stuff, and there's been some uproar, but that makes a tremendous amount of sense. Let's not expose people who are, the outcome is likely to be much worse.
German Prime Minister just predicted that the infection rate there could reach 70%. Is there a difference between being infected and then having the disease?
That's really a key component of when we think about this. So when we think about cases, we typically are talking about those that got infected and they didn't clear the infection. So they have a disease event after that. So just like the common cold that goes around every year, and this is not the common cold, but the common cold that goes around every year, you and I may be in the same room, and my wife had a cold here 2 or 3 weeks ago. It went on for weeks, it seemed like everybody's cold has gone on this year. And I never had a sniffle out of this. I felt bad maybe for 24 hours, but I cleared it, right? So I was probably infected, but not diseased, because my immune system kicked it out. I'd seen it before, whatever. She was not, and she got disease. And that's really what's going on with this. We're going to have a lot of people that are infected. They see the virus. Their immune system deals with it. They move on. And there are other people who see it, and their immune system doesn't get rid of it right away, and now they're going to end up having disease. They're going to be sick. And so I think when Angela Merkel is talking about a 70% infection rate, she's really talking about the number of people that are going to see the virus and clear the virus, not the number of people that are going to actually have 70% of Germany is not going to get sick. I would predict that. If you just look at epidemic theory, it's probably going to be a lot higher than 70%. At some point over the next couple of years, right, we're probably all going to see the virus, right? Because we all commingle and we all move around, but we're not all going to get diseased.
Let's talk about testing here for a little bit, which I feel like is a hot topic also in the media, because there seems to be some issues with, do we have enough tests available, and are we going to have to ration the tests, and who gets priority to be tested? So can you talk a little bit about why is it important to test, and how are we going to use that as an asset to control this?
Yeah, ideally, let's just go to our fantasy land. Ideally, we would test all over the United States all the time, somewhat regularly.
Random population sampling?
Random population sampling. Because what I really want to know in an outbreak is, where's the disease? Where's the virus at in this case? So where's the pathogen at, and where is it moving?
Why do you need to test people? Why couldn't you just test all the doorknobs in the grocery store?
We could sample doorknobs. Okay. That's exactly right. We just need samples globally. Now, there's differences in sensitivity, but what you're really asking the question is there is, where's the virus? Because if I know where the virus is, then I'm going to design my limited movement orders, or, hey, don't go here, to stop the spread. That's the idea. So why didn't we do that is the question. So then you really have to start making the hard choices of, who should I test and who should I not test? And their strategy has been, in a really limited testing availability, really available lab capacity, to test those that are diseased to know where they're at. It's above my pay grade to decide if that was the right strategy. I mean, conceptually, I would have done some different things, but I don't fully understand the limitations that they've had. And so, ideally, we'd like to know where that infection's at, and we just haven't had the testing resources to get that done.
What's the end game here? What's the goal if you're in charge of this outbreak in the U.S.? Is it just, we want to eradicate this thing or control it?
Well, we'd love to eradicate it, but that's not going to happen. The genie's out of the bottle. So we're really in this idea of flatten the curve. How do we have fewer cases or extend those cases? If we think about controlling mortality, and we see what's happened in Italy, and that's a good healthcare system, right? I mean, that's not some backwards, non-industrialized country that doesn't have anything going on, right? This is a modern healthcare system that would be well respected. They've just overwhelmed it. They didn't stop transmission. It didn't, right? They appeared to be aggressive. It wasn't aggressive enough. It really got out of control. Which is what happens when you first get outbreaks of diseases in regions, right? I mean, you don't fully get your head around it, and it's hard to be aggressive and get it. We do it all the time. So I'm not being critical. That's just a fact of what happened. And so now that's overwhelmed the healthcare system. They don't have enough ventilators for the people that need them. So I think our goal is, goal one is, How do we not overwhelm the healthcare system at once?
And that goes back to flattening the curve.
That goes back to flattening the curve. And then how do we really focus on protecting those that are most likely to die? Because if you're just going to get sick and you miss a couple of days at work, and I've got to prioritize that against someone who's going to die, we need to shift our resources, which are limited, to protect those that are really going to die. And this is just much like influenza and right, how do we protect vulnerable? And that's really what we're going to have to focus on. So it's a suck less program, for lack of a better term.
Where do vaccines fall into us controlling this?
I think that's where we're going to really get ahead in control. But, you know, as we've talked previously, that's not going to happen tomorrow. Vaccines are hard. We don't want to put a vaccine out there that doesn't work. We don't want to put a vaccine out there that's not safe. Really, that's a big issue, right? Safety first. We don't want to do any harm. And so we got to get a vaccine built. They're working like day and night on that. We got really, really smart people working on that. I just continue to be impressed as you read the stories and, you know, right, I'm a nerd, so I sit around and read a bit of the scientific literature. The stuff they've done in the last 2 months is mind-boggling. They're really, really smart people working really, really hard on this, but it still only goes so fast. And so
it's going to take us a year and a half.
It's
going to
take us a year and a half or 2 years before we get mass distribution of a vaccine. But that will slow it down and that'll help. And probably at some time, the virus will burn itself out. We'll get herd immunity. We'll get everybody immune enough that the probability of contact between an infected and the susceptible drops low enough that every infected person creates less than one new infection, and that's the end of the outbreak.
So that's the question of, when is this over? It's over when we have herd immunity. Is that the right way
to
think
exactly
of it?
Right. And so what we don't know is, when are we going to get herd immunity? Because if you could knew that amount of information ahead of time, that'd be really critical for these decision makers. We started this talking about, we've closed all the colleges and now we have to open them. We're going to have to bring students back, open them back up. That's a pig term, right? So that's horrible. I shouldn't be using it. But when are we going to decide to open classes?
Let's open back up a pig
so
term.
So I close the herd.
Okay.
And I'm going to open the herd to movements again.
I see.
Well, this isn't a herd. This is a college campus, and we have students. But we're going to have to make a decision one day to say, no, we're going to have in-person classes again. So when do you do that? So ideally, that would be at the end of the epidemic. So if I knew that, that would be really cool. I would predict, right, if you look at every other infectious disease, and this is just pattern recognition of what's happened with other ones, respiratory diseases tend to get better in the summer. We have sunlight. The virus doesn't survive outside the host quite as well, outside a person quite as well. We're all outside. We open the windows, yada, yada, yada. We're not, you know, indoor, inside, hanging on doorknobs, et cetera. It'll probably get better this summer, regardless of what we do. And then the question is, did we get enough herd immunity so when we all come back inside next fall, do we see another burp? Do we see another bump in the epidemic curve? And so I don't know that. Nobody knows that. And I think that's why everybody's trying to really be aggressive now to say, can we control this thing enough that we don't go through another increase, another epidemic curve come winter again?
That was Jim Lowe talking with Ashley Mytak from the College of Veterinary Medicine here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois in a podcast called The Round Barn. They gave me permission to do some editing so that it would fit in our program today. This morning, I talked with University of Illinois agricultural economist Todd Hubbs about the impact this might have on corn demand.
First off, at the top, there's going to be an economic contraction. It's just, what's the duration and severity of this contraction, and what does that mean for agricultural commodity prices? An extended, deep in the summer contraction is not going to bode well for commodity prices, period. If we can get this thing through the system in a couple of months, I'm just sort of trying to think about what kind of demand hit can we see. And one of the most immediate places is an ethanol use for, you know, corn use for ethanol. A lot of industry analysts are saying a 15 to 20% drop in gasoline consumption as people cancel travel plans, major metro areas stop commuting. In that kind of scenario, over 2 months, I've tried to calculate, you know, what we would look at, somewhere between 120 and 170 million bushel hit for corn used in ethanol production. And if it extends longer than that, it'll be worse when you think about weekly offtake. We haven't seen it show up and ethanol production data yet, but it's coming, and it may be here as soon as this week. So that's the one place that's the most worrisome, I think, in terms of corn demand. if we get through it in a due manner, that trade, that price fight between Saudi Arabia and Russia looks like it's going to be around for a while, we could see some low gasoline prices this summer. And if economic activity is back to normal, you'll see a strong recovery in corn use for ethanol. Now, I don't think we're going to be able to make up the hit we're about to take, but it'll be good. So that's one place. Exports. We've seen exports with these low corn prices pick up in recent weeks. We've seen some really big buys out of South Korea and some out of Japan for corn. As we see some of these Asian economies start to pull back from the measures they took under the COVID-19 problem, I think there's an opportunity for corn exports there. It may take a while, right? But we've seen sales pick up recently for the 19-20 marketing year. We're still well behind pace for the USDA's forecast, and it's going to take a significant increase in export sales for us to get back to that place. One of the wild cards is that Safrina crop in Brazil. A good portion of that's going in outside the ideal planting window. If they short that crop, it's going to lower world supply and basically take another competitor out of the export market this summer. So it's going to be important to monitor the weather down there, particularly in Paraná and the southern provinces as we move through April and May. Feed use, I think we've had really strong feed use. I think we might find out if the March 1st corn stocks report that comes out on March 31st, you know, what kind of quality issues and low corn prices, how that's impacted the rations. I think we've seen strong feed use for corn in the first two quarters. One of the worries is we've seen livestock prices drop precipitously over the last few trading sessions. I'm worried that, you know, we may have problems with the meat processing sector and all these event cancellations and that big supply backs up into the system. Now, we've seen strong buying. And if you've been to your grocery store recently, you might be having trouble finding chicken or hamburger. You know, strong grocery store buying that may offset some of that event stuff, but it's not going to offset it completely. So when I'm looking out, issues for feed use and corn maybe later in 2020, because the herd's still out there and we're putting them on heavier weights, and if it backs up, they still have the livestock to feed. So in the immediate future, I don't see that being as much of an issue, but maybe in the second half of the marketing year. But overall, you know, if we can get through this thing in a timely manner, which a timely manner looks like a couple of months, by the time we hit the hot part of the year, you know, we could see demand come back and see some strength in corn prices. So if you're still sitting out there looking to sell corn, I know it's a risky proposition to maybe wait till mid-May or June when we're seeing this kind of carnage in the markets. But I think lows are going to be put in the not-too-distant future, and hopefully we'll see some recovery if we can get through this shock.
You can read more from Todd Hubbs, agricultural economist from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I, on the FarmDoc Daily website at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Find us online at willag.org. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason.